This is David Birdsall of the Mark School of Public and International Affairs. And the first thing I do in the morning is turn on LI News Radio and listen to LI in the AM with Jay Oliver.
Indeed, Joe Campbell at the top, off the record, on the record, and indeed part of the great Mark Stanley, the Austin W. Mark School of Public and International Affairs at Baruch College. David Birdsall, always a pleasure. Great to have him back. Sir, how are you? Hope you're well.
Doing well, Jay. Great to be here this morning.
Good to have you aboard here. So it looks like it is on as far as the articles of impeachment, David, being sent over to the Senate as of today and 2 weeks from today. We will see the start of a trial. And a lot of people had thought, maybe optimistically speaking, that we could maybe sidestep this situation and concentrate on bringing this country back together again. But many hell-bent on trying to bring justice into play and to really kind of coronate the former president into not running again. And that's what it's all about. So he doesn't seek a situation of 2024 and getting back to the presidency. That's what it's all about, really, to most. But certainly today, a very big day in American history.
It is a very big day indeed, and of course, one of the results of delaying this for 2 weeks is that we do have the opportunity, the Biden administration and the Senate will have the opportunity to focus on other issues, such as getting cabinet appointees confirmed or not, and moving ahead or not with the coronavirus package that the president has proposed. To the tune of $1.9 trillion, following on, of course, the $900 billion effort that came through in the early days of this month. So we have an interesting path ahead of us. And beyond getting Donald Trump not to run again in 2024, which would require actually a second action, if, whether impeachment is successful or not, to bar him from running, which requires a majority vote, rather than the supermajority required for impeachment. It's also a question of holding someone accountable for violations of the law. And of course, there are split opinions in this country about how serious those violations were, but a lot of this stems from the outrage over what happened on January 6th of this year.
Yeah, I mean, listen, no question about it. In order to convict, you have to impeach. And when I say convict, folks, it means that they'll need another conviction, kind of another trial to make sure that Donald Trump does not seek office the next go-around. But with that being said, David, this country tries to kind of get back to some sort of normalcy here. Am I correct in saying you're still going to need 17 Republicans to go ahead as far as the next round is concerned on a vote, correct?
That is correct. In order to actually convict following this impeachment, you need a supermajority, two-thirds of the Senate. That's 67 votes. You've got an evenly split Senate at 50-50. So 17 Republicans have to agree to this action. And that's going to be a very, very difficult number to reach if we're reading the tea leaves correctly at this moment in time.
Are we to see the former president at this upcoming trial, in your estimation?
I would be very surprised if that were the case. Presidents have typically not appeared at their own impeachment trials. It is a possibility. And, of course, the unusual, and this is unusual in many ways, it's unusual in that it is actually going to the Senate vote. That's happened twice with Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton. It did not happen with Richard Nixon because he resigned his office prior to the point that it could actually come before the Senate. But it's unusual because it's the second conviction, and it is completely unprecedented in that the person who's being impeached is no longer president. So we're in very unfamiliar territory here, and whether the former president will appear or not is very much in question, but I would doubt it. He doesn't have much reason to do so. And if he were to subject himself to cross-examination under oath, something he has been reluctant throughout his entire life to do, there's so much that could come out. I can't imagine a legal team representing him being willing to place him, in effect, on a stand.
All right, let's go back to last Wednesday, the inauguration, and then down to business. Anything surprise you regarding the executive orders that were signed, 15 of them all together, David, by Joe Biden? Give me an assessment as far as what went down after last Wednesday in your estimation.
These were not terribly surprising. Almost all of them followed directly on campaign promises. The executive orders, to a large extent, roll back portions of the Trump agenda, much of it enacted by executive order itself in the first place. And much of it, in fact, very much unsurprising. So, for example, rejoining the Paris Climate Accords, this is something that Joe Biden said that he would do on the campaign trail. Getting rid of things such as the 1776 Commission, which was impaneled in the very final days of the Trump administration, less than a month to go, when he appointed that committee to basically issue revised standards of teaching American history at school and collegiate levels. These were unsurprising. The only thing that really surprised me, and I think it surprised many people, two things actually. It surprised many people on the in the communities advocating for these changes were the not the executive order, but the legislative push for comprehensive immigration reform out of the gate, and the inclusion of a $15 minimum wage in the $1.9 trillion coronavirus bill. These are flashpoints and hot buttons. They have been controversial for years. It's admirable in some respects that the president is willing to tackle those issues right out of the gate in his first week in office. But at the same time, they are things that are unlikely to bring together the kinds of unity and cooperation required to get emergency legislation passed in the face of the daunting challenges facing the country today.
David, I would agree with you. I'll tell you, the one that really surprised me, and listen, it's a pipeline, the Keystone Pipeline. But when you are revoking, this thing has been like a game of hot potato from the Obama administration, Trump, who basically, did his thing, and now Joe Biden planning to revoke the permit. It doesn't make sense to me, because you're getting rid of a ton of jobs here. Not to mention, to me, a move like this regarding this Keystone Pipeline from Alberta into this country only accentuates what you're trying to do as pleasing is concerned. It's more about pleasing an agenda from those far left than it is about the actuality of the act itself. And that's what really bothers me. Out of all of these executive orders, it's almost as if Joe Biden does not understand the ramifications of this Keystone Pipeline. What about that thought process?
My best guess on Keystone, on the Keystone XL pipeline, is that this is the gesture to the left wing of the party that that cements his pledge not to go for a bigger effort to produce fossil fuel under the Biden administration. You may recall that in the campaign, he was criticized roundly on the left for his previous support of fracking industries. He has never criticized the fracking industry in the way that many in the left wing of the Democratic Party do. That remains the case to this day. My guess is that this is cover for being able to help continue to develop natural gas extraction in the eastern United States, although there are certainly plenty of western United States operations in that regard as well. And that while there is certain to be a lot of hot and angry response from the northern Midwest, and you saw Prime Minister Trudeau over the weekend expressing his regret for the Biden action, which is we didn't expect that the first flashpoint internationally with the Biden administration would be with Canada, right? That's kind of a surprise. But it's also the case that Keystone XL, while it produced many jobs, almost certainly would have been more more relevant in the construction phases than the operational phases, because the economics of producing gas from tar sands, in addition to being perhaps the least environmentally friendly way of getting oil, is also a relatively expensive way of producing that resource. So it was probably not going to be an economically viable solution to begin with. So in actual dollars and cents terms, it doesn't make a big impact. But I do think this is a trade-off for not pursuing fracking in the way that the left wing of the party would like to see it happen.
Yeah, just doesn't make sense to me. You know, I mean, if you're going to tell me it makes it easier for Canada to export its so-called dirty oil from Alberta, well, we already consume lots of petroleum, you know, from the oil sands, so to speak. I mean, according to the Canadian government, from what I was reading, I think it was 97% of its proven reserves are located in the oil sands. The oil sands account for more than 60% of the country's current oil production. It just doesn't make sense to me, especially if you are trying to heal old wounds, and that is restore our alliances, you know, and telling Canada, really, in this move, it's not going to help the cause, so to speak. To me, you're just appeasing an agenda. Yeah, that's what really, out of everything that was signed and everything going into the last Wednesday, this is the one that really bothered me. So, you know, it's interesting. We'll see what happens. Now, let's get to the vaccine rollout. We know it is a disaster. We know it has to be priority one for this new administration. Look at what the state of New York is going through, David. They're getting another 250,000 doses this week. They ran out last week. So it's dire right now. This has not been smooth at all. You want to blame the federal government? Great. I blame both. I blame the state, the way it is handling as far as the execution of a plan that I just don't see. We have pop-up sites coming into play here on Long Island. It is an absolute disaster. How can they correct it?
The Biden administration has pledged that it will step in at the federal level and create a federal plan. That plan is out. It's a 200-page document that I have flickering on my computer right now that I have yet to fully explore. But they are going to provide, if they're successful, relatively more predictability. Operation Warp Speed gave a green light to industry to develop vaccines at an accelerated pace, but it did not put into place any of the distribution logistics that we needed to see, which are, of course, particularly complicated given the delicacy of the vaccines that we have available at this point and the need to have two injections rather than one. You know, all that said, I think you're exactly right. There are plenty of state-level failures, given the initial federal-level failure to create that infrastructure for delivery. And it's mind-boggling, given that we've known since a year ago, really, it's just been last February that we've known that we needed to get these things out, and actually the experimental versions of these vaccines were already in hand, so we knew roughly what the contours of the challenge would be. But nothing happened, and nothing happened in terms of key elements of the distribution chain until last month, which is inexcusable at the federal level, at the state level, everywhere you want to cut it. And for all of us who have been on the state and local websites trying to find a place for ourselves to get vaccinated, if we qualify in 1A or 1B, or if we're over 65 years old, it's just crazy and requires, in my case at least, literally thousands of clicks just to look every morning at what's available and what's not. This is not the way that we're going to get 70%, 75%, 80% of Americans vaccinated before the middle of the summer.
No question. You know, you listen to the CDC director now, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, who's been, you know, all over the media in the last couple of weeks. And she said the big problem is there's just not enough information about how much vaccine is available. And, you know, that's very troubling. And especially when they're reviewing data that suggests now the UK variant, coronavirus variant, could in fact be more deadly than the original strain. Very troubling to me. And even more troubling is, you know, I'm going to tell you right now, David, I'm getting a little tired of Anthony Fauci. He has become a media darling when, in essence, you'd like him to just stick to the numbers of being a scientist. To blame the administration, the past one, on what's going on right now. Listen, we don't need to hear that right now. We need to fix the problem. I don't want to hear about Anthony. You know, really, if you want to go back in time, Anthony Fauci last January thought that this thing was nothing. You know, that nothing to be alarmed about. If you really go back in time and listen to tapes from last January 21st, like I did, I mean, Anthony Fauci right now, his best case scenario as part of this new administration is to be a scientist and not a political pundit. And that's what he has become right now. And it's becoming quite disingenuous, I think, to this country.
I think that, you know, Fauci, of course, has been in service for more than 40 years in the role that he occupies now, or very nearly 40 years in the role that he occupies now, neatly, but has been with U.S. public health for more than four decades, and has amassed a very distinguished record. I think if we go back to January and February of last year, there are a number of factors in play. You know, one is the desire of public officials not to cause panic in the absence of information at that stage, but panic was warranted. Number two was the then stonewalling, and actually the ongoing stonewalling, on the part of the Communist Party of China to just prevent information from coming out about exactly how virulent this disease was and remains, and of course getting more virulent with the variants that you talk about, and then followed immediately by an almost year-long campaign on the part of the prior administration to downplay the severity of the disease and the desire to get the economy back rolling. So I have no doubt that Fauci will continue to focus on the science, but as arguably the most visible health professional in this country, if not the world, I think there is right now a little bit of venting that is perhaps not the most constructive, but I expect him to get back to the knitting as soon as he has a regime available to support him in those efforts. And that does appear to be the case with the Biden administration plan. I mean, just think of it here, Jay, that we actually had an administration for now 11 months that refused to develop a comprehensive plan at the federal level. And we now have a plan within the first week of this administration to fill that void very much needed and very much needed for months. And its absence has cost hundreds of thousands of lives.
Listen, I'm with you. Let's hope that, again, at the top of the list is full concentration on COVID. And that means the rollout, and I get it, Defense Production Act all sounds great. I mean, I think go right to those manufacturers, you know, in Pfizer and Moderna. Listen, you got J&J around the corner. That's a one-shot deal, Johnson & Johnson's vaccine. But to me, you know, it's all about the manufacturers. And that's why we need these numbers to elevate in a big way. And I'm talking going directly to Pfizer and Moderna there. I mean, that to me is how you're going to get it done. It's great to enforce the DPA. I understand that. But let's get right to the source and have more numbers come into play as far as distribution.
Absolutely. We need more vaccines. That is the nub of the problem right now. And you're right, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is very promising and much easier to deal with in several ways. As you point out, it's only a single shot rather than two. It doesn't require the deep refrigeration. It has a longer shelf life. That's true of the AstraZeneca vaccine as well, although that has a somewhat less effective rate so far in clinical trials. And that is also a much easier to handle vaccine. It's out in Europe. It's not out here at this stage. So lots of promising developments on the horizon. But this is a really difficult question. It's a difficult question for the way that we organize medical response overall in the United States. If you think about the problems with Pfizer and Moderna right now, if we believe the companies, and I do, they do not have the productive capacity at present. They actually have to build laboratory capacity. And from a business point of view, if you're talking about private industry, they're going to build capacity that they know will be absolutely necessary to fight this disease right now. But they know as soon as that's done, we'll go unused. So how do you make it possible for that company to do that without suffering severe economic damage immediately following the end of the pandemic? That's going to be the application of the Defense Production Act that is most interesting as far as I'm concerned. How does the government backstop private industry for doing something plainly, squarely in the public interest in a matter of life and death, but at the same time that makes absolutely no sense in terms of long-term business logic? Where do you go to make those companies whole? And I will predict with confidence right now that anything that the federal government does to backstop Moderna, Pfizer, and any other company in a similar position is going to elicit cries of corporate welfare when we get past the virus, when everybody's vaccinated, and when they're getting compensated for the investments that they've made.
Two quick ones. David Birdsell with us. You have a proposed near $2 trillion coronavirus relief package. A lot of lawmakers on the GOP side are questioning the size of the deal, particularly, David, sending everyone a new, a $1,400 payment to go along with a six. Some Dems urging the president not to spend too much time trying to reach bipartisan consensus amid this crisis. That would include the ongoing economic fallout. Where do you think we're at with this? You have the impeachment trial, as mentioned, forthcoming. You have cabinet members that need to be approved officially. Do you think this relief package can get done in time here within the next few?
That's really hard to imagine. It is certainly possible. There are a couple of variables in play here. And, you know, the needle that the Biden administration is trying to thread and will continue to try to thread throughout the next 4 years is to balance the ardent passions of the left wing of the party for social justice, for addressing income inequality, and a host of other factors, with the clear necessity to deal with a Senate that could not be more neatly balanced than it is today at 50-50. You've got things in that $1.9 trillion bill that are poison for the Republican Party, and even if they are applause lines for the left-wing Democratic Party, and for, in the case of the $15 an hour minimum wage, for the vast majority of the Democratic Party, and actually for the vast majority of Americans overall. But putting that in there, what does that do? Is that a bargaining chip? We've heard ever since that plan was issued, the president's spokesperson, Jen Psaki, talking repeatedly about, you know, this is a package subject to negotiation. We're willing to negotiate the items. We aren't necessarily fixed on that. You know, the $1,400 figure comes out of that $2,000 push that was such a hot potato at the end of 2020. It really focused, in many respects, the Warnock and Ossoff races in Georgia. And this is just the $1,400 to make up the $2,000 on top of the $600 that came out in the last bill. One of my concerns throughout, that's politically popular in the United States, even if there are a lot of Republicans who have suddenly rediscovered their deficit hawk credentials and don't want to spend that money. But there are many, 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 many people who would be receiving that money. This would go to close to 90% of people in the United States who did not lose jobs, who have not significantly seen significant losses in earnings if they kept their jobs, as opposed to, for example, waiters and waitresses who have managed to keep their jobs but have seen their income, in particular their tip income, plummet during this period. You know, it's not targeted. It's a very, very broad brush and very expensive way to get relief out to the country at large, and paying that, those relief dollars to literally tens of millions of people who quite clearly do not need it, even if they could benefit it from it in some way. So my questions are twofold. One, how long, how much is going to be bargained away here? How many of these items are bargaining chips in order precisely to obtain that kind of bipartisan patina on whatever is ultimately passed? And how quickly do Democrats on the left push this toward the reconciliation process, where they can push it over the finish line with a majority vote in a committee? That's the question.
David, well done. A lot on the table. Should be a very interesting week. David Birdsell, of course, Baruch College, the great international dean of the Marx School over at Baruch College, of course, ladies and gentlemen. David, well done. We'll talk to you in a couple. Thanks so much for your time, my friend.
Great to be here today, Jay.